The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Jack Stein in for Mr. Dory Monson this afternoon. Looks like we're going to be getting into Phase 2, the reopening plan for the state of Washington. All that and more coming up in The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Big local.
I got to tell you, I think, honestly, that the psychological ramifications of COVID-19 are much worse than anything else anybody could have predicted. When we talk about COVID-19, I think we're focusing on the wrong aspects of it. When people are talking about COVID-19, what do they talk about? They talk about metrics, they talk about infection rates, they talk about death numbers, all those kinds of things. I'm thinking more along the lines of, what is this doing to us as a society, as neighbors, as people who live in a community? And I'll give you an example that happened to me just the other day. Actually, this weekend, I went to my local supermarket. I go there all the time. They know me. And I'm standing in line like a good little boy. You know, they have the X's before you can walk in. Everybody's 6 feet apart. And I get to the front of the line. I put my mask on as I'm about to go in, but as I walk through the front, I don't know what was going through my mind. I just took the mask off, almost as if I was walking into my own home. I didn't think anything of it, popped the mask off, walked right in. I had my headphones in. I was listening to music. All of a sudden, I hear people shouting, yelling, "Sir, sir, sir, what are you doing? What are you doing?" I turn around. There's a group of people, three women, one guy, and they're surrounding me to prevent me from moving further into the supermarket. I think they thought that I was an anti-mask person. Like I was trying to have some kind of that moment where I take out my cell phone and I say, "This is my right as an American to do as I please. You're all being live streamed at this moment." But instead, I just made an honest mistake. But they were treating me like I was a criminal. They were treating me like I was a madman that they had to corral against the bagels. They had to keep me from harming other people. I was so apologetic. I put on the mask and I said, "You know, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to cause any of that." And they were still on edge, as if I had brought a bomb into this particular supermarket, as if I had walked in with some kind of biological weapon. And I keep thinking about, we can talk about things like Phase 2 and the reopening plan and how the Department of Health is saying that, oh, we're just going to open up all these regions back up. And what is this over? It says the department said that the hospital in Walla Walla reported their data incorrectly, keeping the South Central region stuck in Phase 1 due to the metrics. The hospital was reporting all COVID patients they had rather than new COVID patients. The region will now immediately move to Phase 2. That error was discovered and corrected. None of this matters to me. What I want to see is everybody to be able to go back to their jobs and go back to their regular lives. And when I read something like this, the only thing I can think of is nanny state. We live in a nanny state where mommy is watching all of the time and has to make sure that you are behaving correctly. So much so that when an innocent Jack Stein makes the mistake of taking off his mask when he walks into a building, the reaction is, "Oh, mommy's watching. We have to call the police. What are we going to do?" There is this freak out that occurs with people. Let me know if you have experienced this. 98973 State Roofing text line. It is amazing to me the extent to which people have been kind of conditioned to live in fear around COVID-19. And we could go through these metrics. Nicole and I went through them before the show. But yeah, Governor Inslee already announced last week that the East, North, North Central, Northwest, and Southwest regions were moving to Phase 2 on February 14th. The Puget Sound and West regions moved to Phase 2 earlier this month. The four metrics for advancing the phases are trend in case rate, trend in hospital admission rate, percent ICU occupancy, percent positivity, so on and so forth. Shouldn't we be looking at the end goal? Shouldn't we be looking at when this is all going to be over? Because now I'm hearing things about, well, we're going to be living this way until 2022. Now we're going to need COVID relief, according to the federal government, until 2024. Now we're all going to have to, even after you get vaccinated, you're still going to have to wear the mask. You're still going to, and not only that, you might have to wear two of them, maybe even three. I was walking past a guy, I think it was about 3 weeks ago. Cool, really brisk day. I happen to live by the coast. Really cool day, a little bit of rain coming down, but I see him. He's coming towards me. He's wearing a huge mask, like almost something like a painter's mask, but it covered his entire head. And I thought, that is so odd. And as I walked further past him, I heard that it had a whirring noise to it. Like it had a battery. Had a battery inside of it. So when I look at all these policies, I'm thinking much more about what's going on with my neighbors. I don't want to be living this way by June. I don't want to be living this way by, November, some people are saying. But there's so much conflicting information coming out. Oh, you've got a new strain that's coming out. There's a new strain coming out of South Africa. There's a new strain coming out of China. It seems like all the real information about how the vaccine likely will be able to treat those perfectly fine, that seems to be secondary or even tertiary to the idea that new mutations could happen at any point in time. I wonder what happened to the whole kind of Americans can do it attitude, like Americans can handle it attitude. Have we just kind of lost that? Have we just kind of forgot about this idea that we come from strong men and women? We don't come from weak-minded men and women who live in fear. And I'm tired of being told that I have to live in fear. So much so, you know, I think I told you this story last week, but I took a friend of mine. He's 72 years old. He's morbidly obese, and he smokes tremendous amounts of marijuana, and he's a liberal menace, but I love him. I love him to death. He's like a father to me. So he was very nervous about going to get the COVID-19 vaccine. So I said, I'll help you out. I'll set it up for you. I'll take you to the appointment, and I'll get it done with you, and we'll do it together. Great. We go and we do it. I think that that's the way we should be. We should all be more like me in life. Fundamentally, we should all be a little bit more like Jack Stein, where we say, I don't want to live this way anymore, but we take care of the people who need that help the most. Like, Nicole, not to throw you under the bus, but you are in a circumstance where you take very seriously COVID-19, and there are people in your life that you take precautions around. Do tell.
Correct. I mean, I take very seriously. I'm not so much worried that I would get it and become, you know, deathly ill, but I definitely am worried about people around me, like my dad with medical issues, my grandma who's right. 81, things like that. And so I don't want to be responsible for giving it to them and having them get really sick. So for sure, I take precautions. I just got back from a trip, so I'll either, you know, distance for a while, probably get tested, make sure I'm good to go before I go over to my parents again.
And that's responsible. And you would imagine, at least I would, that we're all adults and that people can be responsible like Nicole and myself, and we can all make decisions for ourselves. But instead, we have the mommy state telling you that you're stupid and you can't make those decisions for yourself. And so we have to be on this arbitrary metric system, which makes no sense whatsoever. You have to open this region but close this region as if people can't move around, as if people can't drive. As if people can't go visit other people. I was speaking to a friend of mine the other day on the phone, a guy that I've known since high school. I love the guy. He's a really bright guy. And he said, well, how would you solve COVID-19? How would you solve the COVID-19 problem? I said, well, I would just tell everybody to go back to work, open everything back up, and tell people to be responsible. That's about as best as you can do if you want to get back to a normal life. And then he goes, you know what? I got an even better idea. I said, do tell. He says, what if we all just waited in our homes? The entire country just waited in our homes for 3 weeks and nobody went anywhere and nobody did anything. And then the virus just petered out. And I thought, I don't think that you could do that to Americans. I think that there's this happy middle ground where we allow people to be responsible for themselves and the people that they love. But we do not allow and we do not permit this random turning things off, turning things back on again. This is not something that is tenable. This is not something that can continue over time. We're going to get into it later in the show about people who are losing their businesses, people who are having to leave states for other states just because they are open, just because they are able to do business in those states, but also because Antifa isn't there. We're talking about over the weekend, all the snow that was going on. Antifa militants have had their way with Portland cops throwing snowballs at their backs before the officers finally take over in Bureau. Now, this is really amazing. There's a video that shows a crowd of Antifa militants outnumbering a pair of Portland police officers who then apparently decide they don't want to stick around and talk about the snowy weather. So these Antifa kids are yelling, quit your jobs, and throwing snowballs, and the police just kind of have to take it. They just have to kind of suffer that indignity. And they go back into the police bureau, and then the militants celebrate getting away with it. Again, Antifa as an organization, I don't understand how anybody, whether you're on the right or the left, even if you consider yourself to be a liberal, let's say that you love Hillary Clinton and you think that Joe Biden is just the best and Kamala Harris is going to be the future of the Democrat Party. Let's say that you're that kind of individual. You wouldn't want to be on the same side as Antifa because they hate you, right? Antifa, if we look at what they really are fundamentally as an organization, these are anarcho-communist individuals who think that every system of government is a form of totalitarianism and as a form of authoritarianism. So I don't understand why people are going around saying, you know, Antifa's just an idea. It's just a philosophy. It's just, it's just a bunch of college kids getting together and fighting against the system. No. This is a very well-structured, very well-planned group. It's amazing to me that people still are throwing around that narrative. Oh, it's just a philosophy. It's just a philosophy. They're just anti-fascist. Doesn't everybody want to be anti-fascist? I mean, you think about the branding, it reminds me a lot of McDonald's. You know the McDonald's branding slogans, I'm loving it. How could you not love it? It's McDonald's, right? How could you not want to be anti-fascist? Everybody wants to be anti-fascist, right? But then they themselves, as we all know, it almost sounds like almost a little trite to frame it this way, but they use fascist tactics themselves, going around abusing people. We heard about what happened to Andy Ngo when he was on with Dory last week. It's astounding to me still that people are walking around with this idea that just a fun group of kids. We even see it in Seattle with protesters creating a large snow barrier outside the precinct to prevent Seattle cops from responding to emergencies. I mean, it's amazing. So they built these 3 feet tall snow banks outside of the precinct, not making it so that police can't leave, making it so, you know, the police have the ramp that they have to go up and over in order to get out from underneath the precinct. They built this 3-foot bluff in front of that so that the police can't leave. So about a dozen demonstrators gathered outside the precinct and gleefully cheered when they saw the police were unable to leave the precinct in their vehicles. As the patrol car tried to leave the precinct and it was blocked by the ramp, protesters could be seen jumping up and down and celebrating, hurling snowballs at the vehicle. What's wrong with these kids? What's going on with society where people have gotten to the point? And this is something that really does, I roll it around in my brain on a daily basis. What has caused these kids, these young people, and even in some cases people in their mid-40s, to have such a schism in society where they see themselves as being the heroes of this kind of underbelly? They see themselves as being totally against government, totally, but they themselves are the most violent. The most violent that you could possibly be. Again, as we saw with Andy Ngo, his life is on the line on a daily basis. He can't even go to Portland. So for these people that have these fun ideas about protests in the United States and what protests mean and what it means to celebrate your First Amendment rights, I don't see how doing this is in any way, shape, or form something that we should put up with. I applaud the police for having the patience and the understanding that now they are under so much scrutiny that even if they do try to push back against something like this, the likelihood that it is filmed and then they put it on the internet and then there's some inquiry that's drawn into them, they can't put their careers on the line at this point in time. There was actually a video from New York from over the summer that I just saw. It broke my heart. Two police officers are going up to a group of kids who have opened up a fire hydrant, and they're spraying the water all over the place, and the police are going up to kind of shut it off, right, so that the water doesn't keep coming through the fire. This is back in June. It's really hot. And so what these kids do is they then spray the police with the water, and they get the police soaking wet. And everybody in the community starts laughing at the police. These are guys who put their lives on the line for you and I on a daily basis. That's what their job is. That's a social contract. We pay their salary. They get a pension at the end of their career. And they protect our lives on a daily basis. And you see kids, these are young kids, thinking that they can get away with it. And the part that really broke my heart in the video is there's another young kid who walks up, I mean, he's probably, 20, 21 years old. He walks up with a bucket full of water, dumps it all over the cop. And again, everybody just laughs. And the cops don't do anything about it. I want to go back to this kind of, I want to go back to this era. And maybe it's bygone. Maybe we'll never get back there. But I want to go back to this point in time where you said yes, sir, no, sir to the police, or you said yes, ma'am, no, ma'am to the police, and you were respectful to them and they were respectful to you. I really want to get back to that vision of America. But I don't think that we can when people are celebrating videos of police being harassed. I mean, the likes and the clicks on this particular video of what happened to the precinct in Seattle, It's amazing. And people celebrating this idea that, oh, these cops can't get out. Isn't that so funny? Well, what if there was an emergency? What if they needed to respond to an emergency and now they can't get out because there's a 3-foot barricade there? So I think the reason that we have to bring this up, and you could say, well, Jack Stein, you're nitpicking, and this is just a bunch of kids having fun. The reason that we have to point this out is because the more that we allow it and the more that we don't call it out, the more it's just going to be commonplace. I don't want my non-existent children to grow up thinking that it's fun to harass the police. I don't want my non-existent children who, you know, maybe I'll have one at some point in time, to grow up thinking that it's acceptable to throw rocks inside of snowballs at police. I don't want to live in that world. I want to live in a world where you keep your hands at 10 and 2 and you say yes sir, no sir, and then you go about your business. But when you have this kind of internet culture now where people can look at something like that and celebrate it and think that it's this great achievement in civil rights, that incepts something into the mind in the youth. That places something into the mind where you lose empathy. You lose the ability to recognize that that's a human being who has one of the most difficult jobs on the planet, who is getting assaulted with rocks. You lose the ability to really focus in on that and say, wow, I don't like that. I find it to be disgusting. And that's what I worry about with these kids, particularly in the era of COVID-19, when they are so removed from their siblings and everybody else in their life, and they're just sitting in front of a computer all day, bored out of their mind, having this anti-police nonsense dumped into their brains on a regular basis, not only by Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok, but then also in their own classrooms with teachers coming out and telling them, oh, the police state, oh, we got to do something about the police, police reformation, all these vague terms. There's a solution here. I think that there is a solution here, which is to really imbue that idea into children, really teach that to children, that the men and women who are officers of the law deserve our respect. Even if we disagree with the parking ticket or we disagree with the speeding ticket, they still deserve our respect for everything else that they do for us. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. If you want to check out more of my content, you can go to my YouTube channel. Human Genius is the place to find it. Little brain insignia. Really easy to find. When we get back, national treasure, world famous Hannah Scott is going to be stepping in. We will be discussing a couple of things about drugs. Going to be talking drugs in the next segment. Take a real quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, sitting in for Mr. Dory Monson this afternoon. Dory will be back tomorrow. He positioned his vacation so that he would miss the least amount of actual days, physical days, that he wouldn't be here. And looking forward to him coming back tomorrow. National treasure Hannah Scott has just arrived. Hannah, I need to know, I'm just going to keep calling you national treasure based on what you did to Jay Inslee the other day, because that you should be given a Peabody?
Yeah, something like that. Murrow, yeah.
So what do you got? What do you got for us, Hannah Scott? We're talking about the new drugs coming down the line. People are saying, well, we're just going to completely legalize and everyone's going to decriminalize and everything's going to drugs in the streets, rampant anarchy. It's going to be unbelievable. Tell us what's happening.
Well, I don't think that's what the people behind this are saying. This is the bill in Olympia that would decriminalize small amounts of personal use drugs, all drugs, or most all drugs. And it's similar to what Oregon's voters just approved. Their law just took effect a few weeks back. And it's something that we've been doing here in King County, where our prosecutor does not prosecute those who are busted with a gram or less of any drug. And that's the idea here. The idea would be to take the criminal justice savings that you get from not arresting and prosecuting these people, and then also a whole lot of other investment to invest into treatment and a continuum of care. So not just referring people in diversion to treatment, but also, you know, making sure they know how to access that treatment, hiring those with lived experience, the peer support services is what they're called. So because one of the big challenges, they say, is for people who are dealing with substance use disorder, who they don't feel like they can kick the habit, and they maybe if they see someone who has, they've got a better chance of going ahead and saying yes to treatment and getting on that right path. So that's the idea behind this. Of course, there's certainly plenty of pushback, but Democratic State Representative Lauren Davis, she's behind the bill and is shared her personal experience with the committee this week, last week, and helping an addicted friend as the reason behind her proposal.
There was one particular night that I will never forget. He couldn't find a vein and was growing increasingly frustrated. He would trace his bruised and swollen arms up and down, looking for a spot. He bent over and tried his foot, first the right, then the left. When that didn't work, he went into the bathroom, looked in the mirror, and puffed out his neck in an effort to inject there. After several hours of this, his arms, face, and legs were covered in blood. He began to weep. Tears streamed down his cheeks, and he whimpered, "I can't stop. I can't stop." His suffering was deep and profound. His suffering was so many things, but it shouldn't have been illegal. He deserved help, not handcuffs. Substance use disorder is a response to trauma. The real question is not why the drugs, but why the pain. This disease is about not wanting to experience the present because it is too painful a place to be.
So she goes on to say that if people keep using, regardless of the negative consequences, so the idea that you would, you know, criminalize this and lock people up and put them in handcuffs is clearly not going to make anybody change their behaviors. That's her argument. We also heard from this mom. She's actually a Cairo listener who reached out to me. She had heard me preview this hearing that was happening and hadn't known about it. So she got to go and testify about how this bill would have maybe saved her son.
He desperately wanted to get a job, but knew that getting hired with drug convictions on his record was unlikely. And how would he pay back the money he owed for court fines without employment? He couldn't find a way to get started on rebuilding his life. And that hopelessness and shame he felt made him vulnerable when his old using friends came knocking. After almost a year in recovery and overwhelmed by the long shadow of his past convictions, Ryan relapsed. He died of an overdose at Harborview Medical Center in July 2009.
And then, of course, law enforcement had some concerns.
Let us make clear that Washington's sheriffs and police chiefs would actively support this bill if the provisions legalizing the possession of controlled substances were removed. We encourage the legislature to focus these efforts on what we should do to address the problem rather than what we should stop doing. We acknowledge that the criminal justice system is not an appropriate or effective strategy to broadly address those with substance use disorder. We also agree that the criminal justice system should not be the most accessible path toward treatment. We must also acknowledge, however, that the criminal justice system has proven to be the only effective mechanism to intervene and treat many with substance use disorder.
And there was some others, the Family Policy Institute, which is a larger Christian organization in our state. They came out and spoke out against it. Their fear was that this would kind of change public perception, right? Making people think that it was okay. They pointed to our legalization of recreational marijuana as they said being more used now by youth. I don't know if that's statistically true or not, but yeah, that was their concern.
I happen to be so libertarian on this in some ways, and in other ways, it's just like, I don't think people understand, because I don't know if everybody knows this, I talk about it every time I'm on air, but as a former drug addict with 10 years of street-level drug experience, I can tell you that the thing that was most beneficial to me was run-ins with the law, and also when someone just said no. So I'll give you an example. I was doctor shopping. And that's where you go around trying to find different doctors to give you drugs. And I had a doctor who looked me up and down, and he knew that I was just a derelict heroin addict. And he said, "No, I'm not doing this for you. Get out of my office." And it shook me to the core. So there's two sides of this. Someone, when you get caught with drugs, you can either make the decision to turn your life around or not. And I recognize that it's very hard and it's very difficult because I did it myself. But drug addicts need consequences, and that's why I find this to be difficult to really be totally cool with as a libertarian. If you're a drug addict and you're living on the street and you're committing crimes, the thing that would help you the most is consequences for your behavior. So in the same way that I was kicked out of multiple houses and multiple relationships and finally had a doctor who said, "Get out of my office or I'm calling the cops," I recognized that the reality of my behavior would result in me being arrested or, you know, living and being homeless again. And I didn't want to be that way. So
Go ahead.
So my point is that I don't want to see the criminal justice system overwhelmed by people with low-level drug offenses. But at the same time, a gram of heroin is a decent amount of heroin. A gram of methamphetamine is a decent amount of methamphetamine. So if they maybe lowered that down, just a couple of ticks down, call it a point or two, I might be more on board with it. But they're kind of trying to do this thing where they're trying to equate marijuana with methamphetamine and heroin, and they are just not the same in any way, shape, or form. That's like saying that a Coca-Cola is equivalent to a glass of wine that's equivalent to a full keg, that you're going to do a full kegger at the frat party. It just doesn't line up.
And I think that, I wouldn't say that they lined up either. I think the argument, though, is that, one, if you look around our streets, you can see that what we have been doing hasn't been working for a great many people. Two, that the woman, the mother who you heard talk there in that second soundbite, she had led into all of that with her son had been struggling and had those contacts with law enforcement, like you're describing, but that left him with all of these, court fees and various other things. Mm-hmm. He couldn't get a job because he had this record, and he didn't see any hope. There was no hope at the end of the tunnel. And it's that lack of hope that Representative Davis pointed out is what leads people to stay in this downward spiral. Because why bother if there's no chance of coming out the other side? You've got to be able to answer that hope or offer that hope and then show them that someone who in those peer people who come out and do the outreach with them, show them someone who has come out that other side and been through exactly what they've been through. So I'm with you. I can see both sides of this. I would agree, though, looking around our area for sure, that whatever we have been doing hasn't been working. We also heard from prosecutors who were talking about, look, there's like a massive backlog right now in court cases because of it was bad before the pandemic. Now, because of the pandemic and the court limitations that have been since then, all of these, it helps the courts. It helps the courts.
Hannah Scott, you're a national treasure and you deserve a raise.
Thank you.
And everybody should sing your praises. We got to take a real quick break. I'm Jack Stein filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. When we get back, we got much, much more coming up after this quick break. Jack Stein filling in for Dory Monson. A lot of texts coming in about the most that topic. I think that drugs in particular is something that everybody has really strong feelings about, because most people inherently care very much about what is going on in their community, particularly if we look at King County. And when I was looking through the texts, a lot of people I think it's 253. Was talking about how maybe we should do this thing where if people are arrested with drug crimes, they should have the opportunity to either go to prison or go to rehab for 6 months, inpatient rehab. I thought, well, that's a great idea. Pretty common sense idea, right? Somebody else had the idea, well, what if people with drug convictions were able to get those convictions taken off of their record through community service or recovery? I thought, wow, what a great idea. What a common sense idea. So it's interesting to see what communities can do when they put their minds together to really try to achieve common sense outcomes. But when you have people who are much more in the kind of activist lane, they're really looking for solutions that don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. Somebody else texted in and said, talking about how they were a drug addict. And they were talking about how a gram of heroin is nothing. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. For heavy, heavy, heavy users, this is my problem with this whole proposition that we went through. A gram of heroin for a heavy user is nothing. It's nothing whatsoever. But for someone who's just starting out, for someone who, let's just say, they're 6 months or a year into their drug habit, that might last them all day. So my problem with it is when you try to have these kind of arbitrary numbers and you say a gram and a gram and a gram, anything below that, we're not going to arrest you. Anything above that, we are going to arrest you. It doesn't line up to reality. It doesn't necessarily match reality. I also think that we have this idea that mandatory minimums or somehow be effective when we sentence people for drug crimes, and they're not. I think with drug crimes in particular, because they are nonviolent crimes, and unless somebody commits violence, they should just be treated as nonviolent crimes. They should be given a little bit more wiggle room as to how you process that person through the system. Now, let's say that somebody was high out of their mind and they broke into a business and they stole a bunch of stuff. Yeah, no, they get the full penalty. They get the, in my mind, they get the full penalty. You get them for a burglary and whatever else you can put, vandalism, whatever else you can throw in there. But if someone is just caught intoxicated and they have a gram of heroin on them, they go through the system and the judge says, okay, listen, you can go to prison for 6 months or you can go to rehab. I guarantee you that person is going to pick rehab. And the thing about rehab is it doesn't always stick the first time. Sometimes it takes two or three times. And I think that that's going to be the way that Seattle can get out of this drug crisis, is consequences, is somebody having to realize that the way that they're living their life is dangerous and they just can't do it anymore. I mean, that's the realization that I came to after 10 years of drug addiction, that it was dangerous not only for myself, but for the people around me. And I was so toxic, right? And I was taking the life out of other people. I was just a leech on other people, a parasite on other people. And I think if you're on the streets and you're trying to get out of that, what could be better for somebody who's on the streets? You get arrested with a gram of heroin, and then the police officer takes you to jail, and you go in front of the judge, and the judge says, well, you can go to this inpatient rehab for 6 months, or you can go to jail. Think about what could happen in that 6 months. A miracle could happen in that 6 months. And I think that's the thing that I would like to see happen. Nicole wanted to get to this idea, the View, which I love ripping on, by the way. I might have eaten up too much time with my little drug rant there. But this clip from The View, I just find this to be so cringy and so gross. So The View celebrated President's Day Monday, opening the show with a loving video tribute to President Biden. Co-host Whoopi Goldberg boasted that they could fully celebrate the holiday now because they finally had a president they were proud of. What say you?
Well, I thought we agreed we weren't going to do this story because I don't have the audio ready for you. So we'll have to tease that to the next segment. That's but yeah, so we'll have that audio in the next segment.
Well, it is fascinating. We'll tease this. It is fascinating in so many ways that the way that things were portrayed about President Trump and all of his actions and what he did. The people were intensely critical of the fact that he was going out and he was golfing and wasting his time. And during the pandemic, he should be working nonstop for the people. Newsweek released an article about Joe Biden playing as Luigi, winning in a Mario Kart race against his granddaughter. Oh, so cute. That's really sweet. And it is a really cute story. But if anybody tried to criticize Biden for that, what would people say? Well, you're being mean and you don't understand and the president needs some downtime. That's what everybody else was saying about President Trump when he was going out golfing, right? To me, it makes no sense whatsoever if you're going to come down on this guy for, quote unquote, wasting his time. And then you expect everybody else to just kind of accept the fact that Joe Biden, he's wasting his time, too. It's fine. They're just regular human beings. They do what they want to do. But the outrage doesn't match for me. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
I thought it was funny, too. I saw lots of pictures of, you know, all the living presidents minus Trump, which include George W. Bush. And there was a time where that would have never happened. People would not have celebrated George Bush. But now Trump, you know, I guess consumes everyone's hate. And so, you know, now they'll celebrate George Bush. He wasn't
somebody
Trump.
Somebody edited that photo and they took out Bill Clinton, and they put Hillary Clinton there, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. Mm-hmm. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Dory Monson. We got to take a real quick break. We'll be right back after this for the 1 o'clock hour.